The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott.
I would say that the UK and the ambassador has not served the UK well. We're not big fans of that man, and he has not served the UK well. So I can understand it, and I can say things about him, but I won't bother.
Leaked diplomatic memos by Britain's ambassador in Washington, Sir Kim Darroch, rather upset Donald Trump this week, causing the notoriously thin-skinned president to fire off a barrage of angry tweets and refuse to deal with Darroch. In the end, the ambassador's only option was to resign. But what does that say about the so-called special relationship and Brexit Britain? Also this week, the Tory party continues to tear itself apart as Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt went head-to-head in an ill-tempered TV debate, and John Major threatened to take Johnson to court. And Labour have shifted their Brexit position at last, towards a second referendum. Or have they? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. A furious row erupted this week between London and Washington over leaked diplomatic emails, with Donald Trump subsequently calling our US Ambassador Kim Darroch a stupid guy and a pompous fool on Twitter, and slamming Theresa May's Brexit strategy and claiming his administration would no longer deal with the ambassador. This created something of a diplomatic headache for the UK government and for Boris Johnson, who refused to support Darroch in Tuesday's TV debate. So Darroch duly did the diplomatic thing and resigned. But his resignation prompted criticism from these shores, mainly directed at Boris Johnson, for kowtowing to Trump's bullying. Earlier, I spoke to someone who stood in Kim Darroch's shoes, former diplomat Robin Renwick, who's worked alongside Thatcher, Mandela, George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton and Henry Kissinger. He's written a book, Not Quite a Diplomat, about his experiences. First off, do you believe that Kim Darroch could have done anything differently in these circumstances?
Absolutely not. The minute this leak appeared, I was asked about it, and I said that very sadly, and through no fault of his at all, it's rendered his position in Washington untenable. Because what's the ambassador there for? You know, the ambassador is there to help influence the U.S. government in ways we need to influence them. And if he can no longer have access to the president, the White House, the National Security Advisor, or to the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the military, and so on, what's he going to do all day? All he could do would be to attend cocktail parties. So this idea that he might stay on for 6 months was frankly absurd. What was he going to do? So he took the very honorable and courageous decision to resign. It was exactly what I would have done, and it was the right decision.
Do you think he could have conducted himself in those emails differently? Or do you think that people just doesn't cross your mind that that sort of very private content could be leaked?
Everyone has a different style. I mean, I put plenty of sensitive stuff in my telegrams, but less psychoanalysis, more analysis.
Yeah.
Mine were about how do we get our way? How do we manage to turn things to our advantage and so on? Less about, you know, the personalities. But to give you an example, I mean, I was lucky. I had very close and friendly relations with two presidents, George Bush Sr., but I was reporting at the time that he would lose the next election. And if he'd seen those reports, that would have affected my relations with him. Mm. With Bill Clinton, he remains a friend to this day. But when he gave a visa to Gerry Adams, when Adams was still justifying IRA terrorism, I was furious, and he would not have enjoyed seeing my reports about that. If we can no longer communicate privately, confidentially, under the Official Secrets Act with London, this is a really, really serious issue, and somebody really does need to go to jail for this.
You worked in Washington for a long time yourself, with, as you said, with George Bush Sr. and then Bill Clinton. Can you talk a little bit more widely about how the relationship has changed as you view it since then? Does Britain hold the influence that it once did?
Well, when I wrote in the book that the first thing I did when I went back there as ambassador was to ban any use by anyone in the embassy of the term special relationship.
Okay? We hear a lot of that at the moment.
Because this is you, the media, who love the special relationship. And what you especially love is declaring it dead and buried once every 4 years at least. Now, what it is a specially close relationship. close because we are linked together in defence, security and intelligence. And the economic relationship also, we are by far the biggest investors in America. Most people don't know that, but it's true. Mm. And they're by far the biggest investors here. So we have huge common interests and a lot of goodwill also on both sides, which overcomes these kind of episodes. This particular one won't have much effect at all. But what is different, probably recently, is that I did used to see, you know, George Bush Sr. regularly. I saw Bill Clinton, you know, inside and outside the White House a lot. My main job in Washington was to try and overcome the differences across the Atlantic about what to do in Bosnia. And at the end, not long before I left, I was, you know, after the massacre at Srebrenica, I asked to see Bill Clinton on his own. That's a very unusual thing to happen. And he agreed he would see me on his own. And I said to him, you know, that if we allow this to go on and happen in Sarajevo, the reputation of no Western leader will survive, yours or John Major's or anybody. And he said to me, I've reached that conclusion myself. So then we really did something about Bosnia. In other words, we gave an ultimatum to the Serbs, and when they didn't listen, we took military action against them, and we stopped the war. But you can only do that if you have a personal relationship with the president. Now, David Manning, one of my successors, definitely did have a personal relationship with George W. Bush. But under Obama, he was much more distant sort of personality. I think it was much more difficult for my successors to establish a close relationship with him. And with Trump, I don't think there was any close relationship between these two. But that's not Derek's fault.
I mean, you say it's not Derek's fault, but is it something to do with American presidents perhaps viewing Britain as having a diminishing influence, or is it to do with just the personalities who've been in the White House?
It's probably both. I mean, you know, let's imagine that, you know, the fund of goodwill extends rather widely. For instance, Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi are Anglophiles. Mm. I mean, I have known them both for 30 years. You know, when during the Falklands War, the then ambassador and I went to see Joe Biden, Senator Biden, to get his support over the Falklands. And as we walked into his office, Biden said to us, don't give me any of that crap about self-determination for 1,800 people. We're going to support you because you are British. That was Joe Biden. Now, Nancy Pelosi was a great friend of mine in Washington. And, you know, there they are. They're still there. So if the Democrats win next year, then, you know, we'll be, you know, I think whoever is the ambassador will have an easier task getting on with the president and the leader in Congress. But if it's Trump, we still have to get on with the Trump administration where it matters to us.
Do you think the change in leadership here will make a difference to that? Would Boris Johnson as PM change it with his relationship with Trump?
Yeah, well, the reason this little spat won't have any effect really is because when Boris becomes Prime Minister, which he will shortly, he will want to, you know, have a close relationship with Trump, and Trump will want to do the same with him so long as he actually does deliver Brexit, because what Trump wants is a free trade agreement with Britain. And if Boris gets stuck with Brexit, he'll still have an okay relationship with Trump, but it will be less productive. If, however, we do actually exit, we will need a closer economic relationship with the US, and that we can turn to our advantage.
I mean, you say in the book as well, you were one of the diplomats who helped create that agreement that returned two-thirds of our contribution to the EU budget back to Britain. In your experience dealing with the EU, could the Brexit process have been handled differently with perhaps a more diplomatic prime minister? And how has the negotiations affected us, our standing?
Well, of course it could and should have been handled differently. Firstly, those advocating Brexit, let's imagine that, you know, Thatcher was reincarnated and was saying, right, we must Brexit. And she would say, we must Brexit because we want to regain control over our own laws and our own economy and so on. She also would be saying that this is going to be a really tough and difficult process, you know, that we are going to suffer. It's going to be painful. It's going to hurt. We're going to suffer short-term economic damage in return for what she would claim would be a longer-term gain. none of the Brexiteers bothered to say it was going to be anything other than a piece of cake. So they are looking, you know, rather ridiculous over that. When it came to the negotiation under Theresa May, I couldn't believe how incompetently it was handled. First of all, they didn't choose people who actually had deep experience of negotiating with the EU.
Or with anyone.
Secondly, I mean, if I had signed that agreement, I would have been fired by Thatcher before I got back on the plane. Because the agreement, unbelievably, you know, first of all, she signed on for the Northern Ireland, you know, backstop. But even worse, she signed on for a provision in that agreement that we cannot exit the customs union without the permission of the EU. Now, that's a violation of the sovereignty of Parliament. I mean, it's a fundamental violation. So would I have ever signed that? No. I would have said, right, everything else is agreed, my friends, but not this and not that. Okay? And that's how you have to negotiate with Brussels. And you have to say to them, it doesn't matter how long you argue, we're not going to agree to that. Get this into your heads. You can't do it any other way. Now, you know, because she agreed to all this, to these two very bad propositions, it is now very, very difficult to change it. How could we get out of the situation? What if you want to Brexit, what I would suggest doing for Boris is to say to the EU, right, we are going to leave on 30 October, which by now you want us to do as well, but we will remain in the customs union for the next 2 years. Okay, so there won't be any change to our economic relationship unless you insist on it, but we will not stay in the customs union after that. In those 2 years, we'll try to negotiate a free trade agreement. Because, you know, we have to show that we have a reasonable proposition ourselves. And the reason we're in this mess is partly because they over-negotiated. The little chapter on this in my book is entitled Hotel California.
Yeah,
you know, so that you can check out, but you can never leave. And, you know, the proposition which, I mean, the Labour Party positions changed, thank goodness, but, I mean, its position initially was that we should join a permanent customs union. Again, that's a violation of parliamentary sovereignty, and it leaves us as still subject to all present and future EU laws and regulations with no longer any say in those regulations. So if anybody thinks that's better than remaining, they are barking mad.
Robin Renwick there. Well, I'm joined now by Ellie Mayo-Hagan from The Guardian, Sonia Soda from The Observer, and Henry Newman from Open Europe. So, Henry, this whole episode doesn't really cover us in glory, does it?
No. I think this is quite interesting in lots of ways. I think getting this sort of leak of diplomatic telegrams is quite extraordinary. I think it's quite hard to remember, besides WikiLeaks, anything like this ever happening, where such a huge cache of different emails, these diplomatic telegrams are sent back from our ambassadors all around the world, or our high commissioners. They always go in the name of the ambassador or the high commissioner, to the foreign secretary, and they're written in the form of a letter with updates on what's happening. I think the surprising thing about this in one respect is that nothing Kim Darroch said actually provided a smoking gun. There was no example of the ambassador secretly undermining Brexit or doing something that was totally contrary to the government's policy. It was just embarrassing that they got leaked, because he was rather candid about his impressions of Donald Trump.
Sonia, do you think that, how much do you think of an effect the comments by the leadership candidates, and I think particularly Boris Johnson, had on the decision, or was it just inevitable anyway?
I think it had an effect, and you had people around Kim Darroch, briefing after that debate that actually he'd sort of made up his mind to kind of, or he was basically of a mind that he was going to stay. But when he saw that debate and he saw Boris Johnson essentially, you know, Boris Johnson just would not come out and give him the same backing that Jeremy Hunt did. And then he felt that his position was untenable, because, you know, Boris Johnson is 99.9% now, it's looking likely to be our next prime minister. And if you've got the man who's so likely to be the next prime minister not willing to stand by our diplomat in that way, I think he felt that his position was untenable. I think there's a really important point of principle and precedent here, which is that a foreign leader cannot be allowed to dictate who we do and do not send to represent us in that country.
I think, yes, you're right. We can't have a situation where other countries could choose, pick and choose ambassadors. At one level, of course, they do, because they have to actually sign off on the appointments that
Queen makes. So, for example, we've never had a problem with the US since, I think, it's the 1850s.
It would be, it would be extraordinary. Yeah. Apparently, Trump did come quite close to potentially making him a persona non grata, which would have required him to leave the US. Again, when you sort of step back from this, this is all ridiculous. Nothing that Sir Kim did was do anything other than say what most newspaper reporters are saying about Donald Trump's White House, what most of the books about Donald Trump's White House have revealed as well. So it's just, it's all very strange. I think the deeper problems are several, one of which is politically, for the incoming Johnson administration, this is a very hard thing because it sends a signal to the civil service that they may not have their backs protected by the prime minister. So if you do the right thing, and if you're working for the government, you might find yourself exposed and not having ministers coming out to defend you. That's very, very hard. And I think it also sends an immediate crisis on our US relations, which will be difficult as well.
Ellie, do you think that, you know, that the ambassador necessarily needs to be someone who can champion the government's Brexit policy or who can get on well with the Trump administration? Is that part of the course where the next ambassador needs to be someone like that?
No, I think the role of the ambassador to Washington is to do exactly what he did, which is to report back to Britain candidly and clearly about what's going on in the US. And that's what he was doing. And it's not the first time that an ambassador's correspondence has been leaked. And it also shouldn't be up to Donald Trump to dictate which people we appoint to particular democratic positions in this country. That's not his role to dictate that. And I think the reason why we've ended up in this situation where there's been the resignation and where Boris Johnson didn't come out and offer his support to the ambassador is because Johnson hopes to leave the EU in October and will need to strike up a trade deal with the US, so he needs to keep Trump on side. And I think, you know, I think that's one of the big reasons why he didn't stand up to Donald Trump and why he didn't defend the ambassador. And I suppose, finally, I would just say I'm grateful to Donald Trump for clearing up any suggestion that he radiates insecurity.
Okay, thanks, everyone. We'll be back after this.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Ex-Prime Minister John Major threatened to take future Prime Minister Boris Johnson to court yesterday in the latest surreal turn of the Brexit merry-go-round. Major said he would attempt to stop Johnson if he tried to prorogue Parliament for a no-deal Brexit, a sign of how seriously politicians are taking Johnson's do-or-die promise to leave on October 31st, come what may. And on Tuesday, Johnson crossed swords with Jeremy Hunt for their first televised debate, which was so bad-tempered that some observed it was effectively Jeremy Hunt's resignation note. Henry, what's going on in the Tory party? Did you expect that debate to be as bitter as it was?
I thought the debate was interesting in several different ways. I thought Julie Etchingham did a really good job of basically holding the format, despite a lot of shouting by the two candidates. I thought it was very bad-tempered, particularly at the end. I thought Jeremy Hunt tried to land a whole lot of zingers, and they sort of fell flat. And I think that Boris Johnson, despite having a very incoherent Brexit policy, you could say generously perhaps that it's a bit of creative ambiguity. But I think that overall, actually, I think Boris won most of the bits of the debate that I listened to, even if there were individual policy problems with what he was saying. I think the sense was that on Brexit, particularly the main issue of the day, if you're an undecided Tory member listening to that, you probably would have thought Boris had the better plan.
So can Jeremy Hunt still do damage to Boris Johnson? Did he do any damage on Tuesday night?
He didn't do sufficient damage that he's not going to win the race. I think we're all three of us are in agreement on that. In fact, I think there's not that much that Boris can do now. It would take something really, really immense, well, particularly because a lot of the votes would have been returned. They've already sort of hit the doormat. So the thing is that there's 160,000 Tory members that are voting in this contest, and for all intents and purposes, Boris has won it. But there were just over 4 million of us watching that debate on Tuesday night. So that's millions and millions of people who've got no say over who the next Prime Minister is going to be, but who will be forming quite important impressions, I think. And in that sense, you know, I think think Jeremy Hunt may have done Boris some damage in terms of kind of the way he's seen more broadly. So he might have won it with members with his 31st of October pledge, but he came across terribly. He came across as a blustering bully towards the end. I mean, he was just interrupting, cracking jokes. He just didn't look prime ministerial. And I kind of watched it, to be honest. Obviously, I wasn't the target audience in terms of what Hunt and Johnson were thinking, but I kind of watched it with my head in my hands, just thinking, this is just not even serious, the fact that this man is about to become our prime minister. What does it say about us as a country? And I think there will be others who think that as well. And, you know, a lot of the polling does show, and Jeremy Hunt drew on this on Tuesday night, that actually Jeremy Hunt is starting to look more attractive to voters, including swing voters. The prospect of him as prime minister is more attractive in the electorate at large than Boris Johnson. So I don't think Jeremy Hunt has done Boris Johnson damage to the extent that it's going to benefit Jeremy Hunt. But I think he did do some damage to the prospect of Boris Johnson as prime minister in the sort of minds of the wider electorate.
I would just urge caution when it comes to thinking that Boris being a kind of blustering bully and also having this track record of having done and said bad things, that's actually going to cause him a kind of great deal of damage. Because I think the thing about politicians when they do something shameful is that they have to have the capacity to be shamed in order for that to impact them. And I think this is one thing that you saw with Trump and Clinton, is that Trump was accused of and caught out doing lots of different terrible things. I mean, the grab her by the pussy tape is the sort of the biggest example of that. And he still won the election because he's just an unshameable person. Whereas Hillary was caught out doing with the emails, was a sort of, and because she is somebody who plays by the normal rules of politics, she has the capacity to be shamed. And so it did damage her. And I'm just quite dubious about the amount of damage that can be done to Boris by throwing these accusations at him. I mean, I think that was the kind of playbook that Labour tried in 2012 in the mayoral election and in the one before that. And it didn't work then. And I think it's actually got even less chance of working now.
So I think that's a really important point. The thing, though, is that I think that absolutely stands when you look at a politician like Trump. I think Boris Johnson would like to think of himself as quite sort of Trump-like in his attitude towards these things, you know, his capacity not to be shamed. I can just laugh it off. People love me. They see me as authentic, so I can get away with it. I'm actually not convinced that he's as good as Trump at that, though. And I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a difference between the sort of 2012 playbook, the sort of, you know, he said this, he's made these racist statements. I'm not sure they land. But I think what may well land with the public, and I think this may be behind some of the shifting in the polling around who the public would rather see as prime minister rather than just Tory members, I think Boris blustering and bluffing on TV, it's not quite the same as Trump. I may eat my words, maybe I'm being slightly naive, but I just don't think Boris is going to be able to hold that Trump-like quality in the same way that Trump himself does. I'm wrong.
I mean, I think there's several different things, one of which are important. One of which is that actually whoever takes over is almost certainly going to be Boris, but whoever takes over in just less than a fortnight's time will be inheriting a position where the Conservatives have no majority in of themselves, and their only path to holding on to power is shrinking. They're probably going to lose the by-election in Brecon and Radnorshire, and they've lost now 4 MPs now to defection since the 2017 election that saw them lose their majority. So this is a very, very tough time for Boris Johnson. I think he'll be in a position where, unless he reaches right across the party and brings different people into his cabinet and into his team in a sort of quite generous way, he'll have a huge, huge political problem. So I think that this, either his premiership will be a success if he manages to do that and find some path to delivering Brexit, working across the different parts of the Tory party, or he won't. I think there's an interesting thing also happening in the Conservative Party, that some aspects of the Conservative Party are going through some aspects of Parliament in general are going through a sort of Brexit derangement syndrome, but there's also a bit of a derangement syndrome around Boris. Boris has clearly made unguarded comments, and he gaffes and he says some things that I wouldn't defend. On the other hand, he's not Donald Trump, as we were saying. I don't think he's the comments that he's made are anything like that level. But some people, so it seems that some conservatives now would almost prefer a Corbyn government rather than a Boris Johnson government. And that does seem a strange position. And it's also an
example. How many do you think that actually is, though?
Well, that's interesting. We don't know. And I think it's also an example of how the sort of perspectives have shifted. And Boris Johnson is actually somebody who was a very liberal mayor of London. His instincts are certainly on the liberal side. He defied the Conservative whip to vote against Section 28. He backed same-sex marriage and so on. But just, he's now sort of seen as a candidate of the far right, or the hard right. So he's portrayed as a candidate of the far right, which is ridiculous.
Well, I think if you look at his stance on Brexit, it is very extreme. And I think the thing about Boris is, yes, he may be sort of, you know, his natural instincts may be liberal, but he's shown, for example, in the referendum campaign, that he's willing to get behind some pretty unsavoury stuff if he feels it's going to, you know, improve his chances of getting into power. So I think, but point taken, Boris Johnson isn't Donald Trump. But I do think that there's a real competency issue around Boris Johnson as well. And I think that's where a lot of Tory MP concerns come from, not just his politics. And, you know, the fact that he, whatever went on between Carrie Symons and him behind closed doors, just even the fact that a man who's like literally weeks away from becoming prime minister allowed himself to be in a position where a private row with his partner was like recorded and given to the press. I mean, you know, I'm not commenting on, you know, we've all got our own views about what, you know, what emerged from that recording, but that in of itself shows rank incompetence, I think.
I just want to take a few minutes to talk about between now and October, and we've had John Major say that, you know, he would potentially take the government to court if Boris tried to prorogue Parliament. Something that Boris kept on the table on Tuesday night as a way to deliver Brexit, although not something that I think many of his allies think that he would ever actually do. First of all, does anyone think there is actually a genuine way for Parliament to prevent a no-deal Brexit between now and then, aside from a confidence vote? And also, what do we think of John Major's intervention?
Well, to take John Major's intervention, I mean, my jaw dropped when I was listening to the radio yesterday morning when he said that, actually, because it's just so unprecedented for a former Tory Prime Minister essentially to threaten to take a future Prime Minister to court. And I think for me, what it highlights is just how difficult it's going to be for Boris Johnson to bring the Tory party back together, because you've seen a real... it's just been such a bitter leadership contest. And you've seen a real escalation in recent days. I think John Major's comments, apart from that, completely understand where John Major's coming from. And I think, you know, he was right to say what he did. I think the Sir Kim Darroch affair, I mean, the sort of strength with which Boris's opponents within the Tory party have attacked him for his failure to back him on Tuesday night.
Sir Alan
night.
Duncan.
Yeah, Sir Alan Duncan, exactly. I mean, I just think this is becoming so bitter now. It's just kind of hard to see how the Tory party comes back together.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think that's particularly hard when you've got a hung parliament, as I was saying. John Major's comments did surprise me. I think it's a kind of example of, he's right. I'm concerned about proroguing parliament. I think it would be ridiculous. On the other hand, I think he's sort of, you see these outriders defending proroguing, saying it's somehow equivalent to the decisions that Attlee took in 1948. It's not. Attlee's decision in 1948 was about the Commons not being able to put something its business through because it was being blocked by the Lords. This is about the executive trying to usurp power away from the Commons. That's totally distinct. So yeah, I think the proroguing thing is totally crazy idea. I don't think, again, going back to the discussion we just had, I'm not sure whether Boris Johnson's really serious about doing this, but who knows?
And the problem is in not ruling out.
I agree.
He lets a very damaging, toxic idea that's kind of anathema to democracy take root.
I completely agree.
He's normalising it. Yeah.
I think exactly. But I think, just going back to your earlier question, Jessica, that probably Parliament would find a way, but we don't know that. And it's interesting that some of the real critics of No Deal are now beginning to say, well, look, we just can't find a way through. I also think it's one of the most galling things about the last few weeks is hearing a series of Labour MPs who claimed to be pro-Brexit and then repeatedly voted down the Brexit deal, now saying that they would vote for the Brexit deal as a way of stopping no deal. And you just think, where were you for the last year?
Okay, we'll just have to leave that there. Thanks, everyone. This week, Jeremy Corbyn announced that Labour would finally come off the fence and back Remain in any referendum, seeking to draw a line under Labour's Brexit woes. Remainers rejoiced for all of 12 seconds before they noticed that Corbyn had made no reference to what stance Labour would take in the event of a general election, leaving open the option of Labour seeking to negotiate a better deal to leave. Ellie, why do you think Corbyn is still kind of leaving open the idea that Labour could potentially back its own Brexit deal in any future manifesto, if there's one before Brexit happens?
Just for the quite simple reason that they can't negotiate a deal and then campaign against it. I mean, I think that's what their sort of, I think that's what their logic is. I just think the mistake that Labour is making, and I think the mistake that a lot of people are making about Brexit, is thinking that it was ever about the EU. All the polls show that the British public weren't really that bothered about the EU until the EU referendum happened. I think Brexit has always been about something else. It's always been a representation of, you know, Aditya Chakraborty has written about it for The Guardian lots of times. There is a deep set existential crisis happening in our political sphere at the moment. And for me, Brexit is a symptom of that. And I think the first party to acknowledge that and adapt to it is the one that will kind of win out. And I think by focusing on these kind of technicalities in scenario one, we'll do this. In scenario two, we'll do that. I think Labour is missing the bigger picture, which is that its base want it to embrace a certain worldview. Its base want it to sort of move to a kind of ideological position that they believe that Remain represents. And I think that, you know, which is anti-racist, which is anti kind of disaster capitalist, which stands up to the kind of reactionary right wing views that a lot of Remainers see Leave as representing. And I think that that is really what Labour should be embracing, rather than talking about the sort of technicalities of a particular position.
Isn't the point that they haven't come off the fence? They've still left half a butt cheek on the fence. And the point thing is, you're now in this position where...
Lovely analogy.
Sorry. There's a perverse incentive that if you're a Labour supporter and you want Remain, you don't want Labour to win an election, because if you do, then you might get Brexit, even a Labour Brexit. And if you... I think that's part of the madness.
Or you sort of leave open the idea of campaigning against your own deal in a referendum.
It's
which
absurd.
Is just...
It's just an absurd position. It's an example, again, of how Labour cannot be clear on this position,
I mean,
on this policy.
But it's basically Labour the same just... position as the Lib Dems, though, isn't it?
No, the Lib Dems have basically now
moved quite a bit further, haven't they?
But they would vote for Remain in any referendum. They would campaign for Remain in any referendum.
But they're not going to be in government. That's
no.
the difference.
Well,
I mean, they might be. I mean, they might be. They're probably not going to be in number 10.
Yeah. I mean, I think, gosh, like, you know, on one level, yes, this is another little edge towards a position that the membership want Jeremy Corbyn to take. So, yes, it is a step forwards. But, yeah, it also leaves, you know, it's not completely clear what would happen if Labour won a general election. And I just think, you know, they should say, I mean, the idea that Labour, I mean, Labour is still maintaining this illusion that it can go to Brussels and get a better deal, a deal that delivers all the benefits of EU membership, is essentially the Brexit. The Labour Party position with none of the downsides. And to me, that's just disingenuous. It's as disingenuous as a lot of Theresa May's early stuff, where she was basically saying there's no trade-offs. Labour can't do that. Like, you either say, we accept Theresa May's red lines and this is the best deal you can get, so, you know, that's what should be put to the country. Or you say, right, we want something completely different. We're going to go and negotiate a soft Brexit and back that and put that to the country. In which case, I mean, I'm sorry, they could just say that now. They could say, we're for Norway. They're not saying that. They're being disingenuous.
But even Norway
about
would
it.
Be the backstop.
I just don't agree with
but
this.
No, but
I just think...
to finish, though, but all they could say, I mean, what I think Jeremy Corbyn should be doing is saying, in any referendum, we'll campaign for Remain. If Labour were in government, we'll put it to referendum. We've got this deal from Theresa May. We don't like it, but it's a negotiated withdrawal, and we'll put that to the country, and we will campaign for Remain. Like, I think that's just the only thing that Labour can do, really.
I think that's really... I just think that's really irresponsible, because
Why?
Theresa May's deal is really bad, and I think that Labour...
Well, if you think it's really... It's better than a no-deal Brexit, and there's nothing else
but
that can
isn't
be
it
to the
surely,
country that's Brexit.
Surely it's better to have a situation where if Labour were elected, that they could then try and improve on the deal that we
They're
currently have.
They're not going to be able to, Ellie.
So that we can... Well, I don't think that's true, because Michel Barnier has already said that he thinks that some of Labour's ideas that they've put forward...
Only if you change the red lines. So what Labour could say right now, if it wanted to be upfront with voters, if this was genuinely its position, it could say, we know that we could get Norway Plus if we wanted it. I mean, the EU have basically said that. So Labour could be like, right, we will go and negotiate Norway Plus and we'll put that to the country and we'll back it. But they're not saying that,
I think they should say that
would be an upfront, honest position to take.
I think that would be upfront and honest, but I think it would also be absurd, because you've got a position at the moment where the Brexit deal is not Brexity enough for a lot of the country. You end up in a position where you offer Norway Plus, a softer version of the current deal, versus Remain. And I think that would just cause a huge political disenfranchisement. I think one of the interesting things, though, is this whole kind of argument about Remain is sort of without any of the developments that are happening in Europe at the moment. You know, we had the appointment of a whole load of new senior figures within the within the different institutions of the EU. And you've got a position where the Federalist is now nominated in charge of the European Commission. Whether she's confirmed or not, it's not yet clear. And you've got a failed politician in charge of, that's the European Central Bank, and a failed politician in charge of the Council. And whatever you think about the EU, I think it's much harder to now look at those appointments and think, wow, there's this great case for like Remain and Reform. And that sort of whole argument is missing from the pro-second referendum law. You don't hear anything
about
it.
There isn't a good argument to stay in the EU. And this is why, and I voted Remain and I would do so again. This is why I say...
Of course it's a good argument to stay in the EU. There hasn't been
a single argument made in the public sphere since we left the EU by people who want to reverse that decision that will appeal to the public and that makes a popular case for staying in the EU. And I firmly, firmly believe that unless things radically change on that front, which I don't think that they will, we will leave again. I think the results of the EU referendum, the EU elections, I apologise, confirm that. And that's why I do think it's right for Labour to try and negotiate a better deal, because I think in all likelihood, if they got into office, we would end up leaving again unless a
really... What do
you
mean when you say leaving again? Do you mean voting to
leave again?
Because Labour have committed to a referendum in all circumstances, right? So even if they negotiate a new deal, they say that they would put that to a referendum. They're just reserving the position on what that would
I think that Remainers, they've been saying for the last however many years, we wanted a second referendum. They've now got their wish from the Labour Party. You will get a second referendum in any circumstances. If Boris is in, we'll campaign for Remain. We'll see what happens if we're in. You got what you wanted. Now go and win it. That's the thing. Go and win it. They haven't made a single argument. What is the popular case for staying in the EU? There isn't one. What is it? Brexit is bad? That was what you tried in 2016 and you lost.
But I mean, I think that's
what needs to be fixed. And the reason I'm getting animated about it is because I don't want to go through another situation where there's a massive increase in hate crimes, where this country is even more divided, where there is even more turmoil, to end up in a worse position than there was before, with an even consolidated far right, with an even more resentful electorate.
But Ellie, I just think that the idea that we can do Brexit, a form of Brexit, and all of that stuff is going to go away, I wish that were the case.
It's not going to go away, but reopening all of those wounds will make it worse,
but Ellie,
not better.
There is literally no good path forward. I don't relish the thought of another referendum. Very few people do. The problem is that if we have a Brexit that increases economic inequality in this country, which every single economic forecast says will happen, the government's own economic forecast, whether you have a soft Brexit right up to a hard Brexit, you know, they have different economic impacts, but every prediction says that it impacts on the poorer parts of the country, the least affluent parts of the country, the most. Like, there is no way that that isn't going to fuel
some more
of the
sentiment. But that doesn't answer the question of how do you propose to win it, and I have not seen anybody answer that question.
If you give me a chance, I agree with you that not enough thought has... There is a great case to stay in the EU. It's very difficult to make a popular case, and that's what we saw in the referendum. I agree with you, too much thought has been put into process and not enough thought into how we win that. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try.
Well, let's leave that there. Thanks, everybody. That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Sonia Soda, Ellie Mae O'Hagan, Henry Newman and Robin Renwick. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.